We're coming up on the screen here. We're just going to have orange the entire time. Like, it's slightly less boring. There we go. Lovely. Good morning, Ignite. Aha, you guys are ready for lunch. Usually I get this sort of reaction after lunch. We're here today to talk about the secure modern enterprise and to kind of put it in the perspective in the sessions that I'm giving this week. I know I've got several, right? A session I gave yesterday that was really deep, right? Super internals focused. We had demos in assembly language. That's not this one. This one we're really trying to bring in the full perspective of how does Microsoft see security today? And a really important differentiator, right, and what we think about and kind of what I want to leave here is that we don't perceive of ourselves as a security company. We perceive of ourselves as a secure company. And there's a difference, right? The security company is trying to sell you more products and, you know, really trying to build things that you buy in order to help make you feel more secure. Most of the time, hopefully, actually making you more secure. But that's not our intent. Our intent is to really be a platform company and have that be exceptionally secure. So we really want to go through the entirety of our perspective here, how we see it, how we look at it, what we're seeing in terms of the threat intelligence signals that we get, and how we're responding to that. Now, the script for a standard security talk like this is to start by scaring the hell out of you, and then move into, all right, here's a series of taxonomies you can use to go through and think about things. So let's get started with scaring the hell out of you. One of the quotes that we love, right, there are two kinds of big companies, those who've been hacked and those who don't know they've been hacked. And that's really the perspective we have. We still live in a world where adversaries are getting in and gaining access to assets really, really quickly. And when we look at, the time that typically elapses between the initial breach, the initial beachhead into the organization, and when it gets detected is still in excess of 200 days. In fact, the European Union put out a statistic earlier this year that said, hey, specifically in Western Europe, that number is in excess of 400 days. That means the bad guys are coming in and partying on your network, in some cases for over a year before you even know they're there. And the amount of time it takes to get in is still really, really short. So what we look at statistically is, when we are able to determine between the initial breach and between when they were able to elevate all the way to domain administrator, I control the entire environment, all of your base are belong to me, is still between 24 and 48 hours. So 1 to 2 days. And that's the adversary. And the adversary is very deliberately trying to be secret and sly and stealthy as they're going about it and often don't know much about your environment. When we see red teams going in and engaging, I have yet to have a red team, a penetration tester, go against a network and not get to domain admin rights in under 4 hours. So we have a bit of work to do, right? It's oftentimes really easy to get in there. We see timelines on the order of 2 to 3 months to get a full recovery or at least kind of getting things started. For some organizations, it's harder than others. For example, I'm sure perhaps you've heard about some of the troubles that Sony had recently, right? That was a scorched earth. They flattened everything. Because interestingly, that's one of the really hard conversations we have with anyone who's had a breach is what are you going to do to respond to that? And if it's been a breach that actually gains domain-level compromise, there are tons and tons of places to hide when that has happened. Lots of places to hide. So then you think, well, should I just start over, right? You've actually gained control, and I can't be exactly sure that you're completely gone. Maybe I'll start over. I'll do a greenfield Active Directory and begin again, knowing that that's clean and do a lot more diligence in terms of protecting that. But greenfields are really hard. Those are projects that go 12, 18 months or longer and tend to be expensive. And it becomes this dilemma. You've got a batch of brownies. There might be some poo in those brownies. We think we've got it all out. Would you like a brownie? And the answer is often, I don't know, is a new clean brownie going to cost me $20 million. If so, I might give that one a go. That that's the tough thing to go against is, hey, how do we resolve? Well, in Sony's case, the choice was made for them. I guess we have to do a greenfield because we no longer have an Active Directory at all. So they got, that's the one bright side, if you will, of that entire thing. The cost is getting really, really big, right? One of my favorite statistics of late, if you really want to get a sense of, hey, what could that breach cost me? Yahoo. You know, in the process, they're looking at having it be acquired by Verizon in the United States. And they're like, oh, yeah, that breach, that's really interesting. We're going to go ahead and offer you $1 billion less because, you're suddenly a lot less valuable, right? The numbers are getting big. We see all kinds of ways that people get into systems. This is one of the things that we're finally making some traction on changing perception, because historically it was always, oh, you know how to get secure? We need two things. We need a firewall and an antivirus. Done and done. Problem solved. Antivirus is specifically designed to look for known bad code. So it doesn't really help if someone's created some brand new bad code targeting you. Problem number one. Problem number two, over 99% of all adversary activity does not take place using malware. They get on your system, they get shell, and they just use the tools you already have there that would even survive an application whitelist. So you're protecting against the wrong things. We see people are still not doing the basics of patching. 99.9%, that's a staggering number, of exploited vulnerabilities, they were exploited more than a year after they were patched. 90% of them was more than 7 years after they've been patched. I had a conversation with a customer. They happened to be in South America. I went down to visit them, and I'm talking, and the CISO says to me, he's like, listen, I don't feel I have any defense against 0 days. I need to figure out what to do about 0 days. Now, knowing I was going to go in to talk to them, I did some reconnaissance. I got a sense of what their environment was. So I knew the right question to ask next. So, okay, 0 days, great. It's a very, really, really good question. What version of Java are you running as your standard right now? He kind of looks at me like, that doesn't seem responsive to my question. Why are you asking that? And he's like, we're running Java 1.6 update 22. Why do you ask, right? Now, I knew that already, so I'd already done my research and hopped in to poke around and see what it would actually cost. Does anyone know what the going rate for a Windows 0 day is today for a fully patched Windows system? $2,000? Higher. One that's going to span a bunch of different platforms, right? It's going somewhere between $50K and $100K for a really high quality 0 day spanning multiple platforms without dependencies. So $100,000 to get a Windows 0 day to target something's going on there. Does anyone go shopping for exploits and know how much it costs to buy an exploit for Java 1.6 update 22? Well, you might be able to get them for zero. I didn't find one because obviously in the marketplace, you only find the people who are selling them. They might be zero. You can actually buy them for 25 United States cents. Now, nobody is going to spend $100,000 on a Windows 0 day when for a quarter, 25 cents, they can go and get a Java 1.6 0 day and hop right on in. The fundamentals we still have a lot of opportunity on. The other interesting bit is looking at some of the malware that's on there, right? And this is one of the principles I will tell to people is be mindful of where you're getting your advice from. Security folks, right? What motivates them? What motivates the people who you're talking to? What are the biggest sources of information for a typical enterprise customer in terms of what they should do for securing it? Number one, someone who's selling you a security product. They're happy to have conversations with you about security. And they're often really, really smart. But what are they financially motivated to do? To sell you stuff. Which means their ultimate concern is not how do I make you safe, it's how do I get you to buy stuff. And wouldn't it be convenient if it actually does make you safer, because then you'll probably buy it again and again, right? There is some incentive, but it's not direct. The other one is, well, what about if I'm a security researcher? I'm trying to get on the stage at Black Hat. Their motivation is fame. They want to find something novel and interesting that gets them on the stage, gets them renowned so then they can charge more money as a consultant. All very rational, but their motivation primarily is not, again, to help you. And that actually has been a problem lately where we noticed a large percentage of those who were interested in security were not looking at commodity malware. And the bad guys figured that out. So they were just taking commodity malware, the kind of stuff you go, oh, yeah, that again. Yeah, that's not a big deal. And driving that en masse and using that to compose some really big breaches. Gain access to a lot. Some of the breaches that have happened relatively recently have been on the back of commodity malware, not custom hyper-written for you, even though every single time the articles say this was a highly sophisticated attack that must have been done by a nation state. Nope, this was just someone saying, hey, this stuff's already on there. What if I just grabbed the remote shell and started driving it? And we're getting really, really fast and efficient with the bad guys getting in, right? And if you look at how long it actually takes for me to move forward, if I were to send a phishing email to a typical company, I send to 100 people, 23 of them statistically are going to open it. Of those 23, 11 of them are going to go ahead and open the attachment, and 6 of them will do it in the first hour. So that's kind of what we're up against. And we're up against problems in data leakage, where we regularly have folks just uploading things to arbitrarily cloud services, emailing critical information to the wrong person because of helpful features like autocomplete, and we look at the cost per record going up. This varies a little bit, right? It's actually, for me, one of the things we've been seeing is the rise in ransomware. Well, what's the reason for the rise in ransomware? Why are they taking that particular tactic, right? And to a large extent, it's because depending on the asset, the value is changing over time. So in the United States, as one example, we have about 300 million people who have a social security number. And that number can be used to gain you access to all sorts of other assets, put it on an application, maybe get some credit in another person's name, whatever the case may be. There's some value to it. There are 300 million in total, 200 million of which have already been stolen. So the incremental value of each one gets less and less. So if they can't grab a bunch of information and sell it on the open market, then instead they'll be like, well, I'd rather make 25 cents per desktop by compromise. Why don't I just encrypt the contents of the desktop and say, hey, give me 25 cents or $300 or $500 or whatever the case may be, right? So being mindful of that attack mentality. Now, our approach is to break the effectiveness. How do we really understand the economic model behind what's happening, if it is for economic purposes? You know, because if you know, we need to look at what they're doing today, we need to look at how do we recover, we need to eliminate other vectors, right? Our approach is to take this background of doom and gloom, which despite all of that, turns out we're still doing a pretty effective job of using technology today, right? It's really very interesting to me. You know, we have, you know, folks in our team who will be working with a customer and they'll come out of working with them and go, I am never going to bank with them again. But yet banking as an industry still kind of works, right? It's all a matter of continuing to move forward, continuing to drive everything forward. So we've been invested really heavily in building solutions. To give an eye chart, which is not my typical kind of thing, but I just thought it was an interesting perspective, is someone tried to graph out all of the things we're doing in the cybersecurity space within Microsoft and came up with this. Now, my response to that is, I can't imagine that ever being useful to anyone anywhere, but at least it gives us some kind of sense of the scale at which we're taking this, right? This is trustworthy computing 15 years on. How do we continue to help people leverage our platforms and feel really good about it? So that's the end of the scare the crap out of you part. And now we want to figure out, okay, what are we thinking in terms of how do we get things going and think about what taxonomies we can build and think about road mapping, right? And the concept of the roadmap we find to be extremely important because you can't do everything. It's an interesting world being in security today. If you run security for an organization or you know, you work in the organization that's responsible for it, the job has changed. The job used to be find all of the things that I have to do and then do them. And that's not the job anymore. The job is now find all the things that I have to do, pick which of the things that I have to do that I am not going to do because I don't have the time or the resources in favor of other things that I have to do even more urgently. I need to change that perception. I need to keep going, understanding that I'm operating against a human adversary. That, by the way, has its advantages and disadvantages. The advantage of having a human adversary is that, like you and I, our human adversaries are incredibly lazy. If they don't need to invent something new, they won't. If you can just throw out a phishing email and get six people clicking on it in an hour, you're not going to bother changing your tactics. The disadvantage is they get quite clever when those lazy techniques don't work anymore. So it's evolving. So we've got this roadmap. Road mapping is also very interesting because the other core principle of security to be mindful of is not have I done everything, if not despair, because if the bear is chasing me, I don't have to run faster than the bear. I just have to run faster than my friend. So to build out the taxonomy of how we think about, you know, hey, what's the right way to go about securing an organization, whatever the case may be, is to build out this framework that we think of as the secure modern enterprise, which kind of has multiple tenets, right? There's a foundation. There's some things you really ought to start doing, right? If you're not patching stuff, that's table stakes, right? You need to figure out how to get things patched in the first place. If you're not going to take the security patches in the platform, it's going to be really hard through detective controls to keep an eye on that. So really understand how to get the platform secure, get it modern, get it up to date. What I like to say it as it should be always up to date as your business as usual behavior. That's what we strive for, right? And not just, we're doing a lot of changes within Microsoft on making the licensing model agree with that, right? Because the old perpetual licensing model, right, buy one, hold on to it for as long as you can, right? Vintage is good. You know, these are not 1950s Ferraris. 1950s computing technology doesn't have a lot of nostalgia value. Older isn't better. And when everything lines up, you end up in a better place. So build the foundation and then think through four pillars of identity, applications and data, infrastructure, and devices. Four key pillars. We're going to go deep on one of them, and we're going to preview a little bit of depth on the other one. There's a whole other session dedicated to that tomorrow. We're going to focus specifically on identity because it is what we're seeing today, the most important area of focus. 75% of all active exploits, breaches that take place leverage identity. If you're a bad guy, you don't want to be sitting there doing something that's against the rules because your opponent is looking for people breaking the rules. Instead, you want to pretend to be somebody else who's allowed to do the thing you want. And now that you're pretending to be them, everything looks legit. Right? That's kind of why behavioral-based analysis is really coming into prevalence. So let's dig into identity, right? Because this really is, as we think of it, it's the new perimeter in security. And I'm sure you've heard that before because it's kind of one of the mantras and the calls to action that we say is you no longer have firewalls. We live in a world where most of the computing devices we use today move around. There are several in the room clearly moving around, hopping on untrusted networks. By the way, it always amuses me when you have an unencrypted network and you're sitting in a security session, you say, I think I'll connect to that. That seems perfectly safe. Always amused by that. And you're connecting in most every situation to at least some cloud services, whether it be software as a service, infrastructure as a service, platform as a service, is almost always something you consume. Typically, that something is Facebook, which occupies somewhere on the order of 40% of all web activity, interestingly enough. But those boundaries no longer exist. I could have the best perimeter defense in the world, but I'm not behind the perimeter most of the time. Building my castle and its lovely moat no longer fixes it. Identity is where it's at. If I can pretend to be you, then I can pretend to be you in all kinds of scenarios that matter, even if you keep me outside of your data center. And that's important because of the typical attack chain that we see. Right? I'm going to do something, typically send out a phishing email. One of those 11 people is going to grab it. This is Ben the Beanie Guy. Right? I'm sure you've seen something like this on many, many occasions. But then start to spread around laterally once I've made the initial compromise, grab other devices until eventually I grab the device of someone who has some really juicy credentials, And I'm able to then move up, compromise the entire domain, and now I have everything. So what you kind of see here, I'll draw attention to, because this is an important concept when we think about how do we do protections, is our tier model, right? Another taxonomy that we use within Microsoft to help define how we think. The tier model is relatively straightforward. Some people add additional, couple additional tiers. It's fine, right? The idea is this. Tier zero is the identity layer. That's where you have control over who's who. Tier one is where your actual business data lies in bulk, right? It's your databases, it's your services, your applications, right? It can be a service or a server, doesn't matter, right? That's where the actual business applications live. And tier two is the workstations, right? It's because of this tier model that tomorrow's session that focuses on the endpoint is called securing tier two. What do you do about the workstations? The reality in terms of the value of digital assets is that the sum total of all tier two devices is exactly equal to the sum total of all tier one devices. If it's business data that has any value to you, someone can see it. Otherwise, it has no value. Tier one tends to be more valuable for two reasons. Number one, there tends to be fewer devices. There are not many organizations that have more servers than workstations, so the average value of each is higher in tier one. The other reflects back to the earlier point that our human adversaries are lazy. Which would you rather do? Wait and watch someone's screen for a Delphi app written in 1998 to eventually show on the screen the bit of information that you want? Or hop onto the Oracle database, execute a SQL query, and dump out all of the records that you want? Yeah, I'd grab it from the database, right? I'm lazy. I don't want to take all these screenshots and monitor and look at this crazy Delphi app. I just want to get there. But if I have all of them, all of tier two equals all of tier one. The novel point is a single tier zero identity is equal to the sum total of all tier one and all tier two. Because now I can have control over all of them. So that determines the average value. And we say tier zero and not just domain admin, because tier zero is a lot more than domain admin. If on your domain controller you are running managed antivirus, whoever manages that antivirus is a domain admin equivalent. They're a tier zero identity. If on your domain controller you have backup software that's running with privilege, then whoever controls the backup software is a domain admin equivalent. If your domain controllers are running on top of a virtualization fabric, whoever is your virtualization admin is a domain admin equivalent. If you have another server with an agent running on it, a service account that is a member of the domain admins group, then every single individual, every identity that has privilege on that server is also a domain admin equivalent. Tier zero admins can get really big. Even if you have eight domain admins, you may find that you have quite a bit more when you really start exploring what would be a domain admin equivalent. Up to and including some pretty big numbers. One customer of whom the members of domain admins through one particular route happen to include, rather inconveniently, authenticated users. Or the customer that was probably the friendliest target I've seen so far, they had agents running on every single desktop, and the agents ran with a service account that was a member of domain administrators. One device equals all of them. Not even a backdoor, it was right there on the individual device. So here's what we want to protect against. So how do we really do that? We've got the table stake stuff. We talked about this already, right? Run my security updates. My domain controllers, it should be even more aggressive. I'm taking more than 7 days. How do I make that go faster? How do I start removing local administrator privileges from my users so it's harder for them to move around and manipulate the devices? How do I start to move towards baseline security policies as opposed to bespoke security policies? There is, let me actually pull up a couple of blog posts that are really, really worth looking at. This is from my demos this morning. Sticking with, oh, there we go. Oh, come on, it's coming up. There we go, Ryan. Hyperlink. Obviously, I go here quite a bit. I use this all the time. So this is a blog post written by my friend Aaron. And kind of talks about, right, don't make your own. We see this a lot, right? When we ever release a new platform, the IT admin is usually like, all right, where's the Excel sheet with all the new group policies? If you've ever seen the Steve Martin movie, The Jerk, it's literally almost like, the new group policies are here, the new group policies are here. And the next step of action is, let's go through every single one and pick the best choice, one by one. That's never gone wrong for anyone, by the way. We start talking about, you know, some of the consequences of that. This is one of my favorite. If the guy who manages your app deployment gets hit by a truck, you'll probably just go out of business. Bespoke solutions are risky. So we've been doing a lot of work to publish security baselines. Windows 10 security baseline. Here we go. Nice little link right at the top. And I can go and see the baselines, right, for Server 2016, Windows 10, whatever the case may be. I can go in and see. We have very recently published 1607. Incidentally, in case anyone has the same mistake I did, I honestly had no idea what the 1607 meant, and I asked, and I felt like kind of an idiot when they went, well, 2016 and the seventh month. Did you really just ask me that question? So for anyone else who also was like, oh, I didn't even think about that, now you can know the answer and not have to ask yourself and feel like the idiot that I did. But we have these baselines that are developed in conjunction with high security agencies. So number one, the default tends to be more secure than most people's security policies that they invented on their own 5 to 10 years ago and have carried forward. So the default is often better. And if you have a high security configuration, we publish them, and these are known and tested. That's important because there are lots of unintended consequences of security lockdowns. My favorite was one where we said, you know what? There's membership in a group that gives you the privilege, the SE debug privilege. Right? And SE debug is often mistaken by folks saying, well, if you need to debug, you need this privilege. No, you can debug all you want without SE debug privilege. You just can't debug a process owned by somebody else. If you have the privilege, you can open up any other process on the machine without passing an access check. And we said, oh, well, understanding that, no one really needs that, so we went ahead and removed everybody. It turns out that by removing local system from that, there was not, at the time that we tried that policy out, a single commercially available piece of database software in the world that would install. Because they all took the SE debug privilege. Right, this is, who would have thought that? The answer is, not us. And everything seemed to be fine until you needed a new instance of a SQL database or an Oracle database or a DB2 database or a MySQL, but any of them, you couldn't install a new one. And it was like, why the hell can't I install databases anymore? Ah, debugged it. And okay, let's turn that policy off. These are the things that get proven out with a baseline. You don't have to go through that discovery on your own. Having some anti-malware, right, it's kind of, I don't place a whole lot of value in that for all the reasons that I've said, but that doesn't mean you can often have none until you get much further down the process of hardening devices than most people are today. Doing log auditing, doing analysis, and having some sense of a security operations center, and making sure you understand what software is on the device, that you have the ability to deploy it, and right, have those fundamentals. All that's really fundamental. And then we start walking down the roadmap, right? What's the easy stuff? What's the low-hanging fruit? What can I do straight away? Most people I know have already done this. I have a separate account for my admins, the A-dash account, whatever it's called. So it's no longer just me who has both my admin rights and my productivity all in the same account. This becomes important because the next step is to, hey, you know what? The account is not enough. Let's get onto a device. A trusted device, right? We call it the privileged account workstation. This is actually something we developed within Microsoft. We called it the secure account workstation. Turns out the lawyers won't let us call it a secure account workstation for anything we offer to anyone else in the public because it sets all sorts of expectations. It's still a really, really good idea. The concept is this. If you have something that's really, really valuable, don't have it with you when you're in a rough neighborhood. So if someone hands you a nice, solid gold Rolex watch covered with diamonds, my recommendation is not to go into one of the worst neighborhoods in New York at 2 o'clock in the morning wearing it with a short-sleeved shirt. That's a bad idea. What is a bad neighborhood in computing? A device that has access to the bad guys. The two most common means of ingress today, your email inbox and your web browser. Don't run those on the device where you're putting your credentials. So we say, here's a secure, more secure place to enter my credentials, do my work where I can assume it can't be compromised. And it's really important to us that level of trust goes all the way down to the keyboard for many reasons. And keyboard, we even go to the firmware level. Let's make sure we have a trusted firmware. We have a process called the known good media process that we run when we're constructing these that will flash your firmware, flash your BIOS, make sure everything is up to date. And we do that because we've actually seen vulnerabilities there. We were engaging with one customer, and we said, oh, we need an external hard drive. We've run out of space. Went to the local Best Buy computing store, right, which is in the United States, right, a big box retailer with lots and lots of computer stuff for reasonable prices. Came back with a brand new shrink-wrapped hard drive, opened it up, ran through the process, and said, ha, there's malware on there. That's odd. Can't use that one. Let's go get another one. Came back, ha, there's malware on there. Carried on. We went through our, the U.S., we have the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, got them involved, and it turns out the entire distribution center had been compromised, and someone had opened up a whole bunch of drives, planted malware on them, re-shrink-wrapped them, and carried on distributing them. That kind of stuff actually happens. So we take the trust to the keyboard. Now, one of the big pieces of feedback that I get is, oh, I don't need to go all the way to the keyboard. What I'm going to do is I'm going to use a VDI approach, so I can lock down the VDI and secure that. Well, the attack chain doesn't take you to the keyboard. So I've been long saying, if you don't go to the keyboard, you don't have a trust, it can still be exploited. And everyone basically tells me, no, you can't. Prove it. So I wrote an exploit to prove it. And I told legal, like, yeah, here's what I'm going to show. Like, wait, hold on, you're going to show an exploit live in front of a giant audience that affects a large percentage of our actual customers. And I said, yeah. They said, yeah, no, don't do that. So I accidentally forgot to ask whether or not it would be okay to show a video of such an exploit. Let's assume they said yes and show what the attack looks like. Right? So in this case, what I've got is the secure VDI scenario. Right, where I'm going to have a, let me make sure it's playing, yeah, it's going. A remote window that I've totally locked down, and from this device, I'm able to go through and do my administration. In this case, it's domain administration. Right, I can go in and change things. This is pretty boring, isn't it? Let's kind of fast forward. All right, so I'm going to see, kind of step through. Here are the user accounts, and I've opened up a command shell, right? All of the typical stuff. Obviously, I'm connecting to the device to do some administration work. So I'm going to have the administration windows open. I'm going to have administrative privilege. I'm in to do my work. The VDI device, very, very secure. But I'm doing it from an untrusted workstation. If an adversary is able to get code running on that workstation, that's what that little window is demonstrating. That is the adversary's code that's put on there. Now, unfortunately, most adversaries are not helpful enough to actually give a window with a pwn button right on the front of it. If, however, you see one of those suddenly appear on your desktop, do not click it. But all it's going to do is use UI automation techniques, richly supported, right, because there's not a single commercially available operating system in the world that supports something that we refer to as authentic user gestures. And now he's starting to pop in a bunch of commands, because he can send those keys directly to that window as if it were you, add a new user, add himself to the local admins group, and even notice that he should clean up and do the incredibly sophisticated cleanup job of typing CLS. And now you can't even tell they were there. And we have seen variants of this that are really quite clever. Right? One variant, what they would actually do is they would take a screenshot of your whole screen, and with that screenshot, they would open a new window and use that and paint that right in front of your window. And then they were doing all the UI automation in the background. So you couldn't even see it happening. And then when they were done and had cleaned up, they would take that window away. So you as the user just thought, oh, Windows froze. Now I know what you're thinking. Most of you think, well, that's never happened before. But some people think that that may occasionally happen. and they didn't even notice. So if I don't take it down to the keyboard, I can potentially lose control of my device. That's why we think it's important. Now, in the evolution of what we build, right, it kind of tends to go through a pattern that you'll be noticing as we go along. The pattern is a lot of these configurations start as, well, let's go figure it out. We'll figure it out with our customers. We'll engage whether through the support organization or the consulting organization. We'll get involved and we'll spend our time, put our heads together, come up with a great solution. All right, some of our solutions, for example, we did in conjunction with a lot of our government agencies within the U.S. and a lot of other countries. I know we also work, you know, here with folks down in the Beehive, where we really are collaborating to come up with really innovative solutions to hard problems. Once we've really got it figured out, step two is we'll publish the guidance. We don't want to keep this to ourselves. You shouldn't have to call us and write us a check to be secure. Right? Until we figured out how to solve your unique novel problem, perhaps it starts there. But then we're like, okay, here's our guidance, right? If you don't have the time, we can help you. If you do have the time, here you go. For God's sake, start doing it. And step three is let's bake it directly into the product. Now, where we are in terms of privileged access workstations is in step two. aka.ms/cyberpaw. Gives the guidance, right? Here's why paws are important, and here's how you build them. Here's the recipe. Now, I'll warn you, it's not a terribly short recipe. Kind of a long one, in fact. Here's how you build it, step by step by step by step by step by step. There's a fair bit involved. To be, you know, up front, we normally engage and develop these in somewhere on the order of 3 weeks to build that. But it's really, really key and important, right? If you're not doing it for domain admin, start there. And then move on down the line. Think of it as gradually improving, gradually expanding scenarios. And then kind of finish the baseline stuff by starting taking, if you're at a point where all of your endpoint devices, all of your servers have exactly the same password, that's kind of a bad place to be. Because once you get one device, you can then go and laterally grab all of the devices. Get unique passwords on every single device. There are commercially available software products that do that, credential vaults that will generate a unique device and store them away in a vault for you. If you don't want to pay any money, we give away something for free. We call it LAPS, so the local admin password solution. And you can install it. It doesn't have all of the same features as a full-featured credential vault, but it's free, and it solves the same problem. The vaults, I think, become a lot more interesting because it helps me better solve another problem of protecting against valuable credentials, the help desk, right? Because how did we always used to do help desk? You would get hired on, part of the help desk, and we'd add you to the help desk group, and you would have local admin rights to every single device in the organization. So you become a bit of a target, right? Because now, if I can't get any further progress on the device I'm on, I just start making it act up a little bit, so you call the help desk, they connect in, and I grab their credentials, and now I'm admin everywhere. Now, fortunately, in all of the organizations I've ever talked to, help desk technician is the next promotion after CISO. So these are always very senior people, very highly. Oh, that's not you guys? You don't do it that way. Yeah, these are people you've barely met. They're brand new. They're right out of college. And they have admin rights to everything. How do we solve for that? Right. So this can be the foundation of that. Say, I want one-to-one admin. I don't want one-to-all or one-to-many. I want one-to-one as part of that solution. Low-hanging fruit. When we talk about PAWS, this is an important thing, that it doesn't always have to be something that I build up with a new device, right? A lot of us, let's face it, you know, we're not as young and fit as we used to be. I'm not, at least, obviously, right? So carrying around a whole lot of laptops in your bag, not so fun. So there are absolutely ways to configure this that will say, you know what, yeah, I need to have the trust go to the keyboard. So if I'm using Windows 10 for my PAW, because why would I use anything old? It doesn't need to run anything other than admin tools. So for God's sake, get a really, really secure one. It's going to come with client Hyper-V. And I can run a productivity device as a child VM on there. Because even though Hyper-V is a proper Type 1 hypervisor, the root VM has additional privilege over child VMs that we don't want to give. We want the most trusted VM to be the root VM inside of Hyper-V, and the others can be children. I can have other things running on there. This device actually happened to come from a government agency because they also had an unclassified risky browsing scenario that they would say, hey, you know, if we're going to go and do something that's on an unclassified network, we have to have a separate VM and leverage that virtualization boundary, which is a security boundary in Windows, to protect access to that, right? And then go through whatever, you know, jump server approach that I have to guarantee that, a lot of approaches. Doesn't have to be a physical device. You know, I've seen VDI used. All of that can work into play. Figure out what works best for you. Get the trust to the keyboard. Thinking longer term, next step, shockingly, more pause. Thinking through the next scenarios. It's either the next administrative scenario. One example of a customer that said scenario number one is domain admin, because if they get that, they get everything. Scenario number two, this is a credit card processing firm. And it was a role where they would have access to the entire stream of information coming in and out of, you know, through the system. This credit card number, deposit the money in this account. Well, if you had access to that, party time, right? Put it all in my account, please. So they put them on a hardened workstation. We're talking, you know, white application whitelisting. Only these apps are going to run. No web browser, no productivity. It is dedicated, special purpose, hardened as much as I can. Maybe that's my next scenario. But think of scenarios. Define where your business value lives. Harden that and just iterate. You don't have to do everything. You want to keep moving the ball forward. Then start to transition into time-bound privilege. Rather than, hey, if I need to be admin sometimes, make me admin all the time just in case. Because, boy, isn't that awfully easy. If I need it, I already have it. Right? It's like if you, you know, think back to when we had physical keys for everything. In my elementary school, there was a janitor who had this giant ring of keys, one for every single door so you can get into all of them. Had him with it at all time. Right? If you were to mug him, you would get all of the keys. Now, they were typically keys to like an old middle school gym, right? So no one actually wanted to get in there. But think if that were an actual valuable asset. Why am I carrying them with me all of the time? If something gets stolen, you want to have them steal as little as possible. And we like the approach of making it a privilege vault. I think it's very complementary to another concept, which is the credential vault, which I kind of talked about around, you know, device administration for a help desk scenario, things like that. Privilege vaults are really interesting to me and complementary in a lot of ways because it allows me to not gate it based on your identity, but based on what you're able to do. So if I log in at 9 o'clock, I'm going to have just, hey, it's me. I can't really do anything yet. But at 9 o'clock, I can make a request. Hey, I'd like to have access to this system. The request will add me as a member of the group who are administrators of that system, whether it be a single server or a collection of servers, if they all are equal in terms of security value, and then go through an approval process. The approval process is either the two most common scenarios, auto-approve, I'd like it, okay, here you go, or the nuclear key scenario, get a group of people, any two of them can say yes. By the way, that's what we do at Microsoft for access to our code signing keys. If you want to sign a bit of code with a Microsoft digital certificate, right, that's kind of something worth protecting because if it's digitally signed as Microsoft, pretty much every Windows device in the world and many others are just going to trust it. So we don't want things signed as Microsoft without a couple people going, yeah, that definitely can be signed as Microsoft. So with two keys, they both say yes, on it goes. Try to avoid the always have Bob approve it. Right, because then when Bob goes out on vacation, everything breaks down. But then you get added to a group. And with membership in that group, you can go and do the thing that you want to do. When you're done, pull away that group membership. There's actually been some work in Server 2016 to help constrain timelines so that that membership, because historically the challenge was always if I add you to a group, you do an interactive login, the group never, ever falls off. So as long as you stay logged in, you continue to have privilege, even though you've been removed at the domain level. Right, so we've been doing some work to solve that. But I'm adding that in. The advantage of that approach is that unlike a credential vault, which is going to be using a credential, and therefore the actual asset I'm trying to protect enables single-factor auth, because credentials are single-factor. They may guard access to the credentials with multi-factor, but the asset says single-factor is A-OK with me. Now I can enforce multi-factor for my most valuable assets. So I can start thinking, hey, when do I want to guarantee that the asset itself never has any kind of single-factor auth getting to it? I can use privilege vaulting to solve that. When is that less critical? I can either use privilege vaulting or credential vaulting. I have a choice. Make the right choice based on the asset that I'm trying to protect and what the risk is. I want to add multi-factor across the board to more and more things today. So starting with those users who have privilege and moving on from there, start to deprivilege things in general. I had a great conversation with one of my friends who's here at the conference who was talking about one of his customers, and they said, you know, we have a scenario where I've outsourced this aspect of management. And in order to do that today, they just give them domain admins. This may be starting to sound familiar, right? That's the principle of most privilege. Because I need some of it, give me all of it. Because I need it sometimes, give it to me all the time. What if we didn't have to give you all of it? Just enough admin is a PowerShell construct that allows you to give permission at an API level. So if the delegation models that Windows provides don't cover the precise scenarios you need, you can instead say, hey, you need to add users and remove users and nothing else. Let me write a PowerShell script to add a user and a PowerShell script to remove one. I'll give the server that the PowerShell script runs off of permission, but not the user. I'll put the user into group membership, potentially time vaulted, to access that script and nothing else. So I'm no longer giving out domain admin. I'm giving you add and remove users membership. And that's it. And I can run those two scripts. And now I can start to further subset. I can begin to do the nirvana of all security people, mistrust more of my admins. I still have to trust you with the things I'm telling you you can do, but I can start shrinking that more towards least privilege. You can do things like lowering the attack surface. We kind of talked about understanding the size of tier zero, right? So the next step is let's start to reduce it, right? Less surface area, easier to defend. And I can also look at putting in some more detective controls. How do I spot when things are happening? And this is obviously an area where lots of folks have been investing in. There's lots of products out there that I can query against. One of the areas that we've gone in is in behavioral analysis. What do we know really well? Active Directory and authentication. We've got a lot of machine learning constructs we're able to build because of the intelligent security graph that Microsoft has been building based on our experiences with consumer services like Outlook.com and Windows Defender and enterprise services, Office 365. We can start to see this behavior and build it in and detect what looks to be an anomaly, not with the goal of replacing your security incident and event monitoring or SIEM, but with the intent of magnifying the effectiveness of the people doing that. They no longer have to look for this easy stuff that the machine can look for you. They can get the easy stuff analyzed for free, and they can use their thinking brains to look for new and novel problems. We've now magnified their efficiency. Let's flip through this and think some of the longer-term things that we think of in terms of our roadmap, modernizing, delegating, breaking that out. There was a session immediately before this session, so if you didn't go, actually, I know her Twitter handle, because that's where I normally interact with her, Girl Germs, was talking about delegation. How do we start to continue to modernize and drive that forward? It's a roadmap. How do we continue to reinvent my process? It's important that this is always a combination of people, process, and technology. I can buy all of the software in the world that has the word security stamped on the front of the box. This is how you know I'm old, because software no longer comes in boxes, but you know what I mean. Doesn't make me secure. I need to think through my processes. I need to continue driving towards having more and more people using multi-factor. That's a lot of the investments in Windows 10 is let's make multi-factor authentication less terrible for end users. That's what Windows Hello is all about. Hey, this is actually convenient and in some cases fun. I love that it winks at me. I don't know why that delights me so much. Maybe because I'm very unlikable in real life and so it's the only one who does that. I want to start building out the concept of an admin forest. For people who are particularly big, how can I start to isolate and further control my domain admins? Moving to doing things like code integrity. We'll come back to the ESA in a minute. I'll talk about that architecture. Code integrity, so I'm going to only ensure that my domain controllers run specifically authorized code, right? So server 2016 gives me what basically is the server implementation of DeviceGuard, as well as protecting my devices against the virtualization fabric with shielded VMs, which is something I can now do in server 2016 if I choose to run my domain controllers on a virtualization fabric. Now, I mentioned in point number three, this active admin forest for AD administration. And I'll talk briefly about kind of what that means to us, which is if I look at this tier model and I look at having access to tier zero, how do I control a domain admin? Because by default, a domain admin has admin rights on every single device in the organization. So they can log in anywhere. So if you say, I'd rather you didn't log in here, they still get to. You can't stop them. Now, I've had people say, aha, but I am clever. I have removed domain admins from this particular group, so they can't log in with admin rights via group policy. Somewhat inconveniently, they're the frickin' domain admin. They control group policy, and they can turn that right off. So I can't control them. So how do I control them? I put the identity of the domain admin into a different forest. So now, as a user, I would log into this device, part of the, in this case, red forest, what's depicted right on the screen, and I would have, through a one-way trust, privileged access in the production forest. But in my forest, I'm a standard user. So now I put in a control. I can no longer walk up to a prod device and log in because it'll be like, who are you? I've never seen you before. It would be as effective as me walking up with my Microsoft smart card and plugging it into one of your devices. If you don't work at Microsoft and trying to log in, your computer will be like, I don't even know what you're talking about. Can you please get this foreign substance out of me? So I've got that protection. Now I don't accidentally stamp credentials somewhere else. And now that I'm constrained to this device, I can start to put some controls. I'm a standard user. I can't even turn those controls off. I can require IPsec. You can talk from this device to these devices, and that's it. So you don't accidentally log into another device, which has happened. It's happened twice when I've seen a domain admin accidentally go onto the wrong device. One time it was purely accidental. We were in a lab, and he walks up. They didn't have multi-factor yet. Walks up to a device, logs in, and then said, oh, crap. And instead of spending the rest of our day doing meetings, we spent the rest of our day saying, OK, when was the last time this machine was rebuilt? And let's look at all of the camera footage of who's been in the lab since then. Let's interview them. It was a very, very boring, for me, afternoon, right? But it was due diligence. They had to see, did they just give away the farm? In the end, fortunately, they concluded they probably didn't. In another case, we had a domain admin who just clearly wasn't terribly mature, wasn't really thinking, and just walked up to a point-of-sale device in a retail company out in the wild and logged on with domain admin credentials because, boy, it made it easier for him to investigate what wasn't working. Now, the real risk there, when you think about a point-of-sale device, is what does it take for an adversary to gain access to a point-of-sale device? Say at a 7-Eleven store or at a supermarket. We've actually done a bit of anecdotal research, right? It's not been statistical in nature, but we said, you know, let's figure out what that takes. We did a bunch of trials. It turns out there are two ingredients that have thus far been completely foolproof. If you want to get access to a device to install whatever malware you want on it, those two ingredients are, number one, a tie. Number two, a short sleeve shirt. For some reason, that makes you look like you're from IT, because apparently we don't normally have a lot of style. If you have a tie with a short sleeve shirt, you will get access to whatever device you want. It has never failed for us. Now he won't be able to log in with that credential. Simply not possible. We can control it. And the architecture also allows us the ability to start to control, hey, we can build some dedicated tier zero services. So I no longer have to trust a system center agent to do my software patching. I can give a dedicated tier zero instance of WSUS to just say, hey, if it comes out, just put it on there, right? Because we may not test it with your 15-year-old implementation of SAP, but I'll tell you what, we'll know before we ship it if Active Directory users and computers doesn't work with a patch 1 month. We'll have seen that. So the likelihood of that kind of failure, really, really small, now it's dedicated. Now all of my ConfigMan admins are no longer tier zero admins. And they'll breathe a sigh of relief. They don't like being tier zero admins, right? Too much risk. I can build in dedicated monitoring. I can build in a dedicated purpose-built certificate authority to support all the things like smart cards and IPsec and all of that. I can get a really tight, really small tier zero and walk down that journey. That's where we are today, right? On identity, we're like, hey, here's kind of the roadmap. Let's keep pushing forward. Start at the basics. By the way, that's all published. So the document version of the last few slides is captured on aka.ms/privsec, P-R-I-V-S-E-C. So you can read the whole thing. We then think about apps and data, right? And what's our strategy there? We're not going to go into all of the depth here, but it's definitely something worth thinking about is when I'm building software, am I leveraging all of the learnings of the industry? Am I leveraging SDL? Am I leveraging what I find to be the most valuable tool for writing great software, which is the threat model? Understand what inputs am I taking that are trusted or untrusted? What could they potentially do? If I build out a threat model and understand where the openings are, I can defend them. If I don't stop and think what they are, how do I defend them? When I think about data, how do I protect against data? Right? A lot of tools that are out there need to be paired with a strategy. I can use the information protection features in Windows 10. I can use Azure RMS to protect my data. But without a strategy, without a technique, without a way to educate my people on what to do when, I either get hung up in some, hey, I need to do everything. It's either all or nothing. And not actually make any progress. To build out that strategy, figure out how do I categorize, classify, and simplify and make it usable. Security has to be usable, or what end users will do is they'll complain and complain and complain until it goes away. I need to think about infrastructure and where I'm building it and where somebody else is building it. Am I doing things in the cloud? And if so, am I taking on my accountability? If I'm in the cloud with infrastructure as a service, I have to patch those OSs. The fabric will be patched for me, right? That happens automatically, but I've got to do the rest. Am I effectively doing that? Do I have the right physical controls if it's my own data center so people can't wander in and plug a USB key into something? Do I have cages around the most important and valuable assets to protect physical access to it? And finally, think about the devices, the endpoint. And we've got a whole 60-minute talk tomorrow really talking about that. I'll give you a bit of a preview. But again, you'll notice it's a cycle. Don't try and do all devices. We run into this quite a bit, right? Which is like, I'm going to have one image doing one thing and one configuration, and they will all be the same. And you've already heard me tell you one example of where it ought to be different. It ought to be different for my privileged access management. It ought to be different. It should be a paw. And there are other scenarios that ought to be different. I should do application whitelisting sometimes. I should do selective blacklisting sometimes. I should do nothing sometimes in order to focus on the right things. Think cyclically around how I continue to modernize what I'm doing, and we'll go into all kinds of depth on this tomorrow. But for us, it's definitely a journey. We are trying to cover another taxonomy here, but how we think about it, we want to make sure we're bringing in the right tools to protect the environment. How do we help make you secure so that you lower the possibility of something bad happen? Assume that you're not going to do perfectly well and put in good detective controls to see things as early as possible and have a response plan for when you get that. And that's response plan. This is one of the conversations we frequently have around advanced threat analytics, or ATA, right? A really easy tool to plug in and set up. You can do it in, you know, probably less than an hour if you're really good. But even if you're reading the instructions and doing it for the first time, right, it's less than a day to plug one of these things in. We used to do it kind of a lot, right? We'd go out and visit customers, and we'd plug it in and be talking about it while things are showing up on the screen. We no longer do that. And the reason why is that not once have we ever plugged it in and not suddenly started seeing obvious indicators of compromise. It's never happened. And if we're sitting in the room with you while those indicators of compromise are coming up, it brings up different disclosure rules for a lot of companies. So because a lot of breaches actually are swept under the rug and you never hear about them, even though they did definitely happen. But if we're in the room, they may have to disclose it publicly, and that makes them very grumpy, so we had to lay down a mandate. Do not plug it in until, number one, you've built a response plan. So our implementation, right, when Microsoft helps out with implementation, we're like, all right, before I plug anything in, right, plugging in, that's the easy part. What are you going to do when this happens? What's the playbook? What about this? What about this? Build out the response plan. Then we plug it in, and then one of those things happens inevitably, and we're like, all right, now we know what to do, and we can react to it. We used to live in a world in which we could say, protect, 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 If they get this, it's game over. And what we've noticed, there has been domain-level compromise at lots of folks you've had in the news. Target, Home Depot, some of the health insurance companies in the United States. Domain-level compromise. It wasn't game over. It was a very, very bad bit of time, right? No one had any fun with it, particularly because adversaries tend to be kind of jerks when it comes to timing. You can recover, and the more you put in proper defenses, the more you put in proper response plans, and the better you get at detection, the better you can continue to improve your security posture and be the defender in this war that we're having with folks who want to take away the joy of computing from us. We're not going to let them win. Thank you very much. I'm 14th Street.